KaiserNetwork.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our panelists for Energy Saving Communities. Mayor of Salt Lake City, Utah, Rocky Anderson. Deputy Mayor of Stockholm, Katarina Taris Wahlberg. Mayor of San Francisco, Gavin Newsom. Former Mayor of Bogota, Colombia, Enrique Penalosa. And our moderator, Dean of Yale University School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, Dr. Gus Speth.
Well, good afternoon. We have a great panel for you. I want to thank you for that doctorate. I never earned one, but I'm delighted to have it. There's so many ambitious professors around me at Yale. I think we all agree that Bill Clinton was right when he said at Davos early this year that the global warming issue is the most worrisome challenge that we face today. And 70% of those emissions come from cities. And certainly the most cheapest and the most efficient and the cleanest way to reduce emissions in cities and elsewhere is through energy efficiency. And so the topic this afternoon for us is right on point and extremely important. Someone once referred to the U.S. in particular as a Saudi Arabia of energy waste, very apt description. So we'll talk about energy saving communities with four really distinguished mayors and urban leaders and indeed international leaders for the example that they have set. There's a lot of good news reflected in what these people have accomplished and done, and good news also in the over 200 U.S. cities that have signed up in the Council of Mayors initiative to at least accomplish the Kyoto goals and do better. We'll start off with the mayor of Salt Lake City, Rocky Anderson. Rocky, your city, under your leadership, set a goal a few years ago for the year 2012 to accomplish a 20% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. And I read in the paper the other day that you've done a lot better than that.
Well, we have. We accomplished that goal in 3 years. We announced the goal on the eve of the 2002 Winter Olympic Games. We said we would reduce our emissions by 21% from 2001 levels by 2012. By last year, we exceeded that goal. And we were able to accomplish that by bringing a laser-like focus to this issue in every one of our departments. We first conducted a sustainability inventory, taking a look at our economic and environmental resources, what our practices had been, what we could do to achieve these kinds of reductions. And throughout our city government operations, we have incorporated just about every measure we've been able to do, and we're trying to keep ramping that up because certainly the Kyoto goals are very modest in terms of the eventual goals that we all need to be aiming toward. But very briefly, some of the kinds of things that we've done. First, we took the low-hanging fruit, the kinds of things that everybody can do at all levels of government and every business. Even as individuals, many of these measures we can all undertake. We have an old city and county building. It was built in the late 1800s, absolutely stunningly beautiful. A lot of chandeliers. We retrofitted all of the lighting, got rid of every incandescent bulb, put in high-efficiency compact fluorescent bulbs, and we achieved a $33,000 a year savings in doing that alone, which when almost all of our electricity is produced by coal-burning plants, is a huge reduction in carbon dioxide emissions. We took some of those savings, and to get a double win out of this, we invested some of those savings in becoming the state's largest purchaser of wind power. Those two things alone, we save taxpayers money, and we reduce carbon dioxide emissions by over 1,100 tons a year. Then we moved on to our traffic lights, and putting in LED lights, high-efficiency lights, low maintenance, saved over $50,000 a year by doing that, reduce significantly the amount of electricity that needs to come from coal-burning power plants. We've been converting our fleet. We now have 89 compressed natural gas vehicles, which not only reduces the amount of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, but also vastly reduces the kind of criteria pollutants that cause so much of our local air quality problems. We got rid of 35 gas-guzzling SUVs. We've downsized every chance that we get in our fleet. Imagine the difference if our procurement policies in federal government, state, counties, and cities nationwide just took those steps alone. It's really paid off both economically and in terms of the reduction of global warming pollutants. The greatest effect that we've had is in not only capturing the methane at our wastewater treatment plant and at our landfill, but also utilizing that methane in cogeneration plants, providing enormous amounts of electricity, again, electricity that now doesn't have to come from coal-burning power plants. At our landfill alone, by capturing that methane and then converting it into electricity, we have reduced emissions by a carbon dioxide equivalent of 17,600 tons every year. Now, on top of those municipal operations steps, we've incorporated good smart growth principles in our planning, especially transit-oriented kinds of development that go along with a vastly expanded mass transit system, far more light rail, and now a commuter rail system that's being planned and part of it being constructed as we speak. We have expanded our recycling program, the amount of recyclable materials in 1 year from incorporating a 90-gallon bin where people could put in all recyclable materials except for glass, expanded the amount of recycled materials by 87% in just 1 year alone. So doing all of these kinds of things, we've learned a lot. We've now taken it to the business community and what we call the E2 business program. E2 stands for economically and environmentally sustainable. We now have some 45 businesses that have signed up where we go out and show them the kinds of things they can do in their own business operations. Amazing and very enthusiastic response from our business community. And then we took it to the next logical step, and we have an E2 Citizens program where we show individuals how they can measure their own carbon footprint and commit to take measures to reduce their impacts.
Thank you very much. Katharina, that's very appropriate. Thank you. Katharina, you, Stockholm has been experimenting with a very impressive and ambitious congestion charge. What's been the real-world effect, and what's been the political effect?
Yes, I will tell you all. First of all, I would like to say that Mayor Billström regrets very much that she was not able to be here today. But I'm very honored to be the one to have the opportunity to tell you about the Stockholm trial with congestion charges. And I would like, as a social democratic politician, start with a small reflection, and you will understand later on why. You can say, we won the battle, but we lost the war. Since Stockholm, like other big cities, suffer from traffic jams and congestion problems, the city council decided in 2003 to ask the Swedish government for permission to conduct a trial with congestion charges. The trial began on August 22, 2005, with extended public transport. And a congestion tax was charged between January 3rd and July 31st, 2006. A referendum was held in September the 17th, together with general elections. The objectives of the trial were a reduction of traffic by 10 to 15%, better accessibility, less exhaust emissions, developed public transport, and improved city environment. The technical system we choose was completely automatic. There were no toll booths. Instead, we used transponders and video cameras. The fee was approximately $2.50 during rush hours and less than $2 the rest of the day. Evaluations showed a reduction of traffic by approximately 22% compared with the same month the previous year. This improvement caused the buses to run faster than scheduled, for example. That was a problem, I can tell you. The results also showed a reduction of air pollutants, such as less particles of PM10, less nitrogen oxides, and less volatile organic compounds. I hope you understand what I mean. VOC. What surprised the experts was that the simple charging structure worked so well, that the effects happened and stabilized so quickly, that the congestion reduction could be seen virtually by everyone and the change in people's attitudes. At the referendum, 53% of the citizens of the city of Stockholm voted yes. 47 voted no. So, ladies and gentlemen, maybe you now think that it is clear and decided that Stockholm will make the congestion charges permanent. Let me tell you, it's not that easy. It is politically more complicated since the final decision is in the hands of the national parliament, not the City Council of Stockholm. And the national parliament might also take in consideration the 14 other municipalities in the region. The region consists of 26 municipalities. 14 more conducted their own referendum. And the result of those were 60% no and 40% yes. They don't want to pay to go to Stockholm. And on top of that, the election 3 days ago now changed the political majority at all levels. The national government, the region, and the city of Stockholm is now governed by an alliance of parties not in favor of congestion charges. Today, we don't know if there will be any permanent congestion charges. We don't even know when there will be a decision. But we will be back in 4 years. And then we know that we have the Stockholmers behind us, and we will run for the office with a clear promise that will give the Stockholmers the congestion tax back to them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Gavin, I know that that you were very pleased to see the state of California recently moving forward in the direction that San Francisco pioneered.
That's I like that question. Can you repeat that? That San Francisco pioneered. I like that. Look, thank you very much for inviting me, and I am proud to be here because I'm a passionate environmentalist in the making. I have the great privilege of representing a city that I think has best been described as 47 square miles surrounded by reality. Think about that. San Francisco has always been a city of dreamers and doers, of entrepreneurs, of innovators, and it's a leading edge city. It's not always of everyone's liking or taste, but it's a city that has prided itself long on having an environmental construct. We're a city that's been very aggressive and addressing our responsibility on a local level to deal with the global climate change that we've experienced around the planet. I think you made a great point that for the first time in human history now, more people on the planet than ever, the first time in the history of humankind, more people on the planet are now living in urban centers than outside of urban centers. And I've heard stats even beyond the 70%, that we consume about 75% of the Earth's natural resources and contribute about 75% of the Earth's pollutants. And I say that as a consequence that at the city level, we have an obligation, a responsibility to do the things that must be done in order to turn the tide as it relates to the global climate. That is why cities like those represented here and hundreds of cities across this country have established local global climate action plans. San Francisco was one of the first to do that. Our goal to roll back by 20% our CO2 emissions to back 20% to 1990 levels by 2012, and we're well on our way to doing that, but we want to go back to 1990 levels. That's about twice what the Kyoto protocols were. We hired one of the first cities to hire a local global climate action plan coordinator to do real assessments of exactly where we were with our CO2 emissions. A lot of cities now are saying they're doing, I think, more than we actually are, because we're not truly analyzing objectively our statistics, and we're trying to do it in a very meaningful and strategic way. A consequence of these initiatives is we have now taken the privileged position of having more alternative fueled vehicles than any city in America. And it was as simple as this, a stroke of a pen, an executive order that said when we get rid of a car, it's out of service. We simply can't purchase anything but an alternative fueled vehicle, save our emergency vehicles. But that obligation now is extended that our emergency vehicles need to use B20. They have to have a biodiesel component. So we have fire engines with biodiesel, Muni now with biodiesel. We have our paramedics driving in vehicles with biodiesel. And we have the most aggressive recycling program, we believe, in the nation, close to 70% recycling rates, just shy of 70%. A goal of 75% by 2010 and zero, which is remarkable, 100%, we believe can be achieved by 2020. They never thought we could do 50%. Now we're exactly at 69 or so percent. We have the largest municipally owned photovoltaic system in the United States of America. We have a program, right? If any of you visited San Francisco, gone to the convention center, that is now the largest solar project in the U.S. And just recently, quite ambitiously, just 2 days ago, we announced an initiative to put the largest commercially owned tidal project in North American history, right at the mouth of the Golden Gate Bridge, in essence, dropping large tubes or terminating in terms of the environmental work we're doing, basically underground wind farm, right at the mouth of the Golden Gate Bridge to take advantage of harnessing all of the energy that is frankly just left day in and day out, making its way in and out of the San Francisco Bay. It is estimated that that one project alone can produce enough energy, just that one renewable project, renewable clean energy, 12% of all the households in San Francisco can be powered by that one project. We're also now trying to advance, and I can go on, I won't because of time, we're also trying to advance a similar initiative throughout the state of California, down the coastline, of taking advantage of wave energy. Again, initiatives that exist in small levels around the world, but no commercial size levels in the United States that have real meaning and impact. And we've been working for years and years to advance that effort. There are so many things that we can do today. We don't need to wait for tomorrow. It is not that complicated. It's a question of political will. There is so much, as we keep referring to in the last session, low-hanging fruit on energy efficiency, on getting serious about building partnerships and incentives. We have green building incentives. We require LEED standards for all our municipally owned buildings. We'll fast-track permits if you're going to get into the business of putting solar on your homes. We're going to fast-track permits if you're going to get serious about coming in as a green company. We have no payroll tax. We just did an exemption for green businesses because we want to replace these manufacturing jobs with green collar jobs, the jobs of the future. Bill Riley heads our Clean Tech Advisory Committee, so we're also nonpartisan. Bush won, and now, of course, a little more democratic construct out in the city and county of San Francisco. So that's just in broad strokes what we're doing, and we look forward to having a spirited dialogue about some other examples as well. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Enrique, you served as mayor of a major developing country city. You took on these issues. Why did you do it, and with what success?
Well, thank you, Gus. I'd like to talk about developing country cities where perhaps the greatest environmental challenges for the world lie over the next few years. According to United Nations, there will be more than 2 billion new inhabitants in developing country cities over the next 30 years. But these cities will grow much more than proportionately because homes will be smaller and also cars will be growing in a tremendous way and travel distances. So there is a huge challenge in the area of transport. urban transport is a very peculiar problem because different from all other problems poor societies face, instead of getting better with economic development, it gets worse. Health or education get better. We have 3 or 4 times the income per capita of today. But urban transport gets worse unless we change completely our model. It takes a change of model and a change on a way of life. And I'd like to emphasize today in a Clinton initiative forum, also concerned with poverty, the links that the same policies that are necessary for social equity, democracy, and solving the needs of the poor are the same that are good for the environment and in this transport sense. Because developing country cities, almost by definition, are areas where only a minority of the population own cars, 50%, 40%, 30%, but almost by definition. So all of these car restriction issues have a high political content. Are we going to invest in people, as has been said so much here today, or are we going to invest in roads, infrastructure for the minority with the highest incomes? Are we going to invest in schools or housing, in parks, or in more road infrastructure, building and maintenance? How are we going to use our road space? Are we going to give it to public transport or to private cars? So there are very difficult political issues. Transport is not really about engineering, but about it's a social and political challenge. And even if cars were totally clean, there is a very large conflict between a city that is friendly to pedestrians, who are the poor, children, the elderly, and many people as well, and a city that is friendly to cars with high-velocity roads, which make life, of course, less pleasant. There are budgetary conflicts. Unless a decision is made not to try to solve traffic jams with more road infrastructure, but rather to restrict public private car use and to invest in public transport, city budgets are going to be devoured by road infrastructure construction and maintenance. In Bogota, we have a restriction that makes that 40% of private cars cannot go during 3 peak hours in the morning and 3 peak hours in the afternoon to the streets. We also, by the way, we had a referendum, but our referendum is very powerful in Bogota, where we wanted to have a car-free day once a year. So we have in this 7 million inhabitant city a car-free day, but no cars at all, no private cars in the city the first Thursday of every February. And the city works fine. 99% of the people go to work, to study, everything, because we have not yet gotten very car dependent, and that's exactly the way we want to keep it. Rail systems are too expensive if one wants to give access to public transport to all the population. Especially in developing countries, the only real solution are buses. In Bogota, we copied the system invented in Curitiba by Jaime Lerner, who is here, the father of these systems which are changing transport in the world, which is a bus system, but that basically works on exclusive lanes, and people pay when they enter a station. They are articulated buses. When the bus arrives, the station doors open simultaneously with the bus doors, and as they are the same level, you can get 100 people out of the bus in seconds and 100 people into the bus in seconds, like the navettes at airport. We are moving now in Bogota, despite the fact that we only started to put this into operation 6 years ago, 1.4 million people every day. People are saving more than 200 hours per year. This is a self-sufficient system that moves people at similar speed to rail systems and without subsidies. President Uribe, whom you heard this morning, is creating 6 more of these bus systems in other Colombian cities. And to finish, I would just to emphasize that we also created bicycle ways. Most of the developing world is either tropical or else doesn't have extreme winters. So walking and bicycle is even more relevant than in the northern cities. We started from almost 0% of people going to using bicycle for their daily transport. We created a more than a 350-kilometer protected bikeway system, which is still growing. And now almost 5% of the Bogota's population is using bicycles, saving 12% of their income. But more important than this is that a protected bikeway shows that a citizen on a $30 bicycle is equally important to one on a $30,000 car. Therefore, I emphasize that all of these democratic and social equity issues are very closely linked to the environmental sustainability issues as well.
Thank you very much, Enrique. It's interesting to pick up where Katharina left off, which was a concern really about sustainability. Rocky, you're retiring, I think, one of these days. I don't know. You've announced you aren't going to run again, I think.
Yeah, I'm not sure I call it retirement, but I'm not going to run for re-election.
Right. Enrique, you have been out of office for a while. How about the sustainability of these important initiatives that you both put in place? Is that going to last?
Well, yes, because in my case, there was no re-election. It was not possible to be re-elected. It's not because I lost the election. I would have probably lost, no. No, actually, the interesting thing is that the model, everything has been adopted, and regardless of the fact that there have been two mayors of different political affiliations, there is a tax on gasoline to finance the increasing of the infrastructure for the bus system, and it is increasing every year. Not only that, but the national government is financing these systems also in other Colombian cities. And basically, there is more and more clarity that there has to be a restriction on car use. I mean, any city in the world where people use public transport and not cars, such as Manhattan or Paris or wherever, is not because they love the environment, but because there is some sort of restriction to car use. And I think there is a little more and more of a shared vision. And despite the fact that there are risks, I think more or less we are advancing in the right path, despite changes in the political affiliations of the mayors.
Rocky?
I think the greatest way to accomplish sustainability is to be successful and see that those successes breed additional successes. I think a great example was the tremendous opposition to our first light rail line. And I know that this is a common phenomenon around the country, that the people can't seem to visualize what it's going to be like to have a light rail system and get people out of their cars. The opposition was so vigorous. The voters voted down a tax increase for our first system. Fortunately, we had leaders who found ways to finance it, to blast through the opposition. And after that light rail system was in place and the ridership was beyond any of the most optimistic projections, and then we built another line off onto that, which dramatically increased ridership. Now we have people in, they've got to be some of the three of the most conservative counties on the planet, actually voted, the voters in those three counties voted a sales tax increase so that they could get mass transit in their communities. So we have that model in everything we do. And when you can show cost savings as well, that helps, I think, toward promoting the sustainability. One other thing that I think is absolutely crucial is in bringing the community into the process. We've created what we call the Salt Lake City Green Team, a very broad-based group of people who have been very involved with getting their input, getting them to go out among their colleagues and bring in ideas and help commit to this program. So it would be very, very difficult, I think, for anybody to come along and try to dismantle what we have put in place, because they've been so successful, these programs, and also the cost savings make it, I think, something that nobody can argue with.
Gavin, Katharina?
You definitely reminded us we come and go, and that I certainly appreciate that. And so it's about institutionalizing these changes. It's, you know, that wonderful book, Built to Last. It's about clock builders versus timekeepers. And it's about understanding the tyranny of or versus the genius of and, that you can have an environmental policy that is an economic development policy that actually grows the economy. It's not an or, it's an and. And once you communicate that, you do have community support. You do then have that sustainability. That being said, that's never good enough. So we created a Department of Environment that has got a very significant number of staff We have a very strong incentive program that's in the books or on the books in our charter that's mandated, can't be changed without voters going back and changing it. We've got strong legislation. Those are ways of institutionalizing the goodwill and the good work that have happened across this country and around the world at a local level.
Thank you. Catherine, you got the last word.
Yes, I think it's very important to communicate to people what it is about all to have a society where you can be very happy to see your children grow up in a society that is long-lasting, that we as adults did everything we could to give back to our children what we may took from them a couple of years ago. I think that is important. And it's also important to see, would like to say the same thing like you did, to see that whole society is gaining on what we are doing and to have a strong regulation because then people accept it and they see they are paid back. It costs too much to not think of environment.
Thank you very much. Thank you, panel, very much. We'll be back.
Again, the panel did a great job. You know what to do next. This time, the two questions focus on saving energy in communities. So the first question is, what can my community do to save energy? And the second is, what incentives do we need to be giving communities to encourage them to move in this direction? You'll have 25 minutes for your table discussion. Okay, folks, please welcome our panel back. They've worked hard on your original set round of questions. And as soon as we get everyone's focus up here, Gus will toss some questions to each one of the panelists that came directly from you. And they'll respond to those questions until we're ready to hear the themes from your table discussions. Okay, thanks very much.
Welcome back. I'm looking at an entirely too long list of questions from the audience, but we will select a few, and then we'll have the themes from your discussions over the last half an hour. Enrique, does green public transport and development have to be publicly financed? What is the role for public-private partnerships?
Well, if there is one good area for government subsidies, is transport, because it has a very inelastic consumption. I mean, the fact that it would be free does not make people ride the bus or the train up and down all day long. So people consume the transport that they need, no more, no less. Yet, of course, I believe that in our case, for example, we only invest in the road for the buses. The buses are private, and it's a private operation, at least in most developing countries and most everywhere. But when buses belong to government, they are extremely inefficiently operated. In Bogota, a publicly owned bus would leave the north of the city and arrive to the south with a different engine. So this is basically private contractors. This is private contractors who operate all the buses. 96% of the system's income goes to private operators, the bus operators, the people who operate the smart cars, in intelligent electronic smart cars, another company. I mean, different private people who share there. And in our case, we don't have any subsidies for the system. But yet again, as I say, if you have a rich enough society, I think it's a very good area to subsidize. In our case, we don't subsidize it because we cannot afford it, but I would like to subsidize it.
Thank you. Katharina.
Yes.
What obstacles did you encounter in your efforts to green your city, and how did you overcome them? in Stockholm?
Well, some obstacles that we meet is when we get rid of our garbage from the families. We want people to put them in the different fractions, you know, and we have very many fractions in Stockholm. We have uncolored glass, we have brown and green glass, we have paper, we have cartoon, we have metal, we have hard plastic, we have soft plastic, and I think maybe a couple more. And this is very difficult, and you cannot put anything with electricity in here, not with where you have when you put it in the wall to get electricity. I don't know the English word for it. But you cannot put that in there. So that is difficult for people to get rid of an old TV that doesn't work or a refrigerator or something like that. Then they sometimes put it on the street near to those bins with the fractions. And sometimes they put fractions outside because they might be unsure what kind of plastic is it or is it full in this bin. And that is drawing rats to the place and people complain. And then we said it must be the responsibility for the producer to keep clean around those bins. And then the producers sometimes use spies, you know, with cameras and trying to take pictures of who was putting what where and number plates of the cars and even going into maybe a sack that was not put in the different bins to see if could we find an envelope with a name to see who is and maybe you read about the old lady that had a frying pan too big to get in the hole for metal, and she knew it was metal, but I think the handle was plastic, so she put it aside the bin, and she was photographed by a spy and she was drawn to court. And she almost died because she was just a little bit too old to be prosecuted for something that she really thought she was doing right. She wanted to do this very well. So we have to, I think, politically see to that we don't have regulations that kill our citizens. Where shall we put the dead citizens that are killed for this? So there's a lots of things we must do. We are overregulated in Sweden, I think.
Here is a good one for Rocky and Gavin. How does city action affect national action and vice versa?
It's amazing what's being done in cities around this country. We have almost 300 mayors now throughout the United States who have signed on to the Climate Protection Agreement. Some 200 are now working with ICLE in really putting these commitments into action. ICLE has been a tremendous partner with the cities, helping us with the software to establish our baselines, measure our progress, provide information as to how we can continue our emissions reductions programs. And if this administration and this Congress isn't absolutely embarrassed by being left so far behind by the cities, then they're simply not paying attention. So I think the greatest impact is that we can demonstrate. Cities are great laboratories for innovation. By demonstrating, as cities are doing all over this country, that not only can we set these ambitious goals, but that we can meet them and we can save money in the process, we can actually get it done. We have the means. All it takes is a political will. I think that's going to be the greatest contribution that cities have in moving federal public policy.
Let me just pick up where Rocky left off. We're now extending those agreements across shores. We established a framework with the United Nations, the World Environment Day. The first time they had ever brought their World Environment Day to North America was last year to celebrate with other mayors from around the world what we're doing environmentally, but also celebrate the 60th anniversary of the founding of the UN from San Francisco. I keep reminding my friends out here that we're happy to take the UN back anytime the New Yorkers feel they've had enough of them. We still embrace the UN. That being said, we were able to establish some protocols with mayors from over 120 cities around the world, very similar protocols that were established at the U.S. Conference of Mayors that Rocky was referring to. But let me just say and pick up, and I have no reason to mince words with the president and the lack of leadership. I've done it on almost every topic, so I happily will do it on this. It is an outrage in this country that we are not standing up and having real leadership on the issue of global warming. It is a disgrace. And the fact that cities across this country have to do the job in absence of that leadership is equally disgraceful. But the fact is we're doing it, and I'm proud of Rocky and everybody else that's standing up and to be held accountable. And just stop the rhetoric. You know, the bar is so low in America that I have a governor out there, Governor Schwarzenegger, that a year and a half ago was considered an environmental hero because he said he believed that global warming existed. Let me repeat that. He simply just stated that he thought global warming was real. And people said, my God, what leadership. And I thought, this is a problem. If it just because he happens to be a Republican governor. I mean, give me a break. The bar is so low in this country. We've got to do a better job. And that ends my partisanship for the afternoon.
Senator Glenn, do you want to comment on this? David Sandiloff.
Well, it's my job to offer some nonpartisan constructive comments here. And they're an unbelievable number that were provided here at the table, just incredible, actually. And we grouped them on the first question about what steps can be taken into four categories. And the first was on transport. As you can imagine, there were lots and lots of suggestions on transport, making city fleets hybrids, building light rail systems and bike lanes, creating an intelligent bus service, as was discussed, and lots of other things in the transport basket. Lots of stuff on buildings, instituting fast-track permitting for green buildings, which we heard about in the first session also, enacting tax breaks for green buildings. Lots of suggestions on education. I love somebody suggested winning the hearts and minds of the city bureaucracy and building all of these issues into school curriculum, obviously, and using schools to take the lead by example. And then designing green communities, suggestions for reducing incentives and subsidies for sprawl, converting waste methane from landfills into energy, and planting more trees. So what incentives would help communities save more energy? There were suggestions for federal incentives for mass transit, for federal incentives for multi-use high-density housing, creating a cap-and-trade program among cities, organizing a clearinghouse of information about best practices so cities could share them with each other, recognizing and awarding public employees who create energy savings, similar to the same employee performance-focused suggestion we had in the first panel. And then an interesting idea to create sister city programs with a particular focus on energy efficiency. Several quotes that I thought were pretty interesting. Somebody said, on a kind of more sobering note, it's harder to retool a city than a company. I thought our panels would enjoy somebody who said, mayors are the most credible messengers. And then finally, if the elders do not understand, educate the next generation. Thanks.
All right. There's so much brain power and experience and talent in this room that I'm sure that you could have written 10 times this amount in the time you had. But I want to ask the panel, how about responding to some of these points? Just pick out anything.
Well, I'd like to make a couple of comments.
Please.
First, bike lanes. Bike lanes are totally useless. You need protected, physically protected bicycles. Any bikeway where an 8-year-old child cannot feel safe is not a bikeway. I mean, like, Manhattan would be perfect. Instead of having all these cars parked along these streets, which are really not really solving any parking problem or anything, if you would take them at least out of one side, you could make a very, very bikeable city where distances are very short, it's flat. But I'd like to just to leave you one a point for thought. Developing country cities are going to be created. I mean, 2 billion new inhabitants over the next 30 or 40 years. But the growth will be much larger than that. Again, as I say, because homes will be smaller, because there are more institutional buildings as a percentage of the area built. So there is a huge challenge for the world there. And so one of the greatest challenges and relating to sprawl is how to avoid sprawl there. Because sprawl is beginning to happen there too, the same. Upper income people are going out to gated communities and all this. So I think this is because sprawl, density is really the solution to all. I mean, we cannot, more important than to decide where we want buses or trains or trams is to really have density. If you have density, you can have many different forms of public transport. You can have walking distances. You can have bicycles. Therefore, how to avoid sprawl? I think one of the ways of doing it is providing people in cities so those things they are seeking in the suburbs, such as a lot of green, a lot of pedestrian spaces for children to play safely. Why not think of hundreds of kilometers of pedestrian networks? For cities that are going to be built from zero, it costs nothing. It would be very easy. We really have to think different in the way we build cities. Who decided that we should not have, for example, one pedestrian street for each car street? For 5,000 years, all city streets were pedestrian only, or at least one pedestrian street for five car streets. So I think we can really think different, and there is a huge challenge out there to create dense cities, but which provide many of the amenities of the suburbs in much denser environments, which, because density really is the key to solving public transport and many of these issues that have been mentioned here.
Could I just make a short comment on education? Because I think it's very important, this, within the hearts and minds of city bureaucracy. In Stockholm, we had a group that had the task to make Stockholm cleaner and nicer. And they were coming from all fields, building houses, planning streets, social aid and everything. And they were bureaucrats, and they were led by a woman who had this task for about a couple of months to have ideas, what should we do. And it ended with a campaign, a very big campaign, directly to the citizens of Stockholm. For example, people throw very much litter on the street. Paper and all those bring your coffee thing with you. They just put it. When it's finished, they put it. Sometimes when it's not finished, they put it very nicely in the corner of a window of a shop or something like that, so it shouldn't spill on the street, but still the cup is there. So we
have need more regulation.
So then we had, yeah, more cameras. We are getting more cameras now, I can assure you. But then they had one idea that was very good. They put as information on the, what is it called, the litter bags, where you can put the litter. They put a big sign, this is the nearest litter pin you have in Stockholm. So just information for people, you can put it here. I think that is very good to win their hearts and minds, because then we get lots of good ideas that goes straight to people. It's better than the politicians are on TV telling people not to throw litter around. And I think it's important also to have it in the school curriculum and schools led by example. And I think it should start very, very early, because kids of 2 or 3 years old, they go home and they really teach their parents what to do and what not to do. So I think it's important to start even in preschool, very important.
Rocky.
In cities, we talk a lot about sustainability and good environmental practices, and yet we see the impact of a lot of our ordinances have been on the books for a long time, and some of the other interest groups like historic preservation folks that want things exactly the same, and we can be our worst enemies. There was a recent example of a gentleman who was willing to spend a significant amount of money putting in photovoltaic panels on his home in an area that is regulated by our historic preservation ordinances. And our planning staff gave him the hardest time because, God forbid, these photovoltaic panels would be seen from the street. Now, that was something I was able to resolve in about 2 hours after I read about it in the newspaper, because there was some discretion in our planning department. But we have ordinances that, for instance, prohibit white roofs. Now, that's been on the books for a long time, but we know that there are some very high efficiency roofs now that save a lot of energy. And the color of the roof, you know, we have to weigh these things. So we recently, to address these things in a comprehensive fashion, created a very broad-based sustainability task force where we're bringing in architects, contractors, developers, and these city staff people who are dealing with these things on a daily basis to look at every one of these obstacles to sustainability and make some comprehensive recommendations as to reform of our ordinances. But I think we see this nationally, and I think that a comprehensive approach rather than battling these kinds of things on a daily basis is really what we all need to do. And all I can say is, especially with the great successes we've seen with high-performance LEED certification of buildings, we have got to put in place every incentive we can, including a rapid turnaround for permits and licensing and all of that, to encourage, to incentivize in every way that kind of building. And imagine if we did that on a federal basis, if we were to convert federal buildings, for instance, over 20 years old and make them all high energy performing buildings, we would not only create hundreds of thousands of jobs nationwide, it would be great for our economy, and certainly it would be great to help lead us toward energy independence in this nation. But in the cities, we've got to lead the way, at least for now.
Darren, just Kevin? To pick up on where Rocky, there's a lot of great incentives that are out there. Chicago's got some extraordinary incentives. Mayor Daley has really raised the bar in terms of fast-tracking solar. We have an over-the-counter $89 solar fee, which is very modest. I can assure you $89 to get a permit to put that solar up. We're doing the same thing with LEED buildings, particularly the LEED silver, gold, and platinum fast-tracking, notably starting at gold and platinum fast-tracking those permits. So there's simple things you can do. On the issue of transportation, Enrique, boy, you are absolutely right. Just striping a lane for a bike is not a bike lane. One of the things that we're doing, and it's integrating both of the themes here, is that we're looking at those linkages. For example, we have building requirements in commercial buildings for showers. The reason we're doing that is because we want to incentivize the utilization of bikes. There is a direct linkage between the two. We now allow, and this was not an easy thing to do with some of my friends in labor, was to allow bicycle racks on the front of buses, to allow bicycles to be used on our ferry system. The idea, come in from another part of the bay on the ferry, you may take the light rail, you put your bike there, and then you may use your bike to get some exercise or get to a part where the transportation system is not as efficient. So the whole idea is integration, that sort of interdependence between all these multi-modalities. Another thing we're doing is car sharing. We haven't really talked much about that. Why is it that everyone has to have a vehicle or be forced to have an inefficient, in many cases, public transportation option, which may not be an option at all. Some people need, especially in our city with those hills, where they have groceries and families, they're going to need that car. They're going to need the space to put those groceries in. They can't jump on the bus, and car share is a viable option. It's something we're seeing in cities across the country as well. One other thing that is exciting, and just a little tidbit, I was reading about a bicycle program in Lyon, France, fantastic with the technology to get GPS tracking system in bicycles and get smart cards and swipe cards, and you incorporate them with a free bicycle program throughout the city of Lyon. We're doing I have a new contract for our bus shelters coming out in San Francisco. This will be a requirement in that contract that if you want to advertise or provide the bus shelters in our city, you also are going to have to provide this similar type of free bicycle program, which is also an exciting way, incentive-laden, not burdensome from my perspective way, really advancing your alternative modes of transportation and advancing some of these issues on bicycling. And finally, there's an obvious linkage, too, with the outrageous realities of obesity in this country that we certainly need to encourage these type of recreational activities that obviously also provide transportation.
Thank you. We have just a couple of minutes, and I want to raise a different type of action that mayors take from time to time and ask particularly our U.S. mayors to comment on this, as we've discussed it a little bit earlier. As many of you know, there are over 100 large coal-fired power plants on the drawing boards for our country. Few, very, very, very few of them have carbon capture and storage associated with them. So this is a projection, leads to these huge projections from our Energy Information Agency of future emissions in the U.S. The front line of this issue, the battle, which I think we see coming on these plants, is in Texas, where the TXU Corporation is planning the equivalent of about seven large, 1,000-megawatt plants. David Hawkins is telling me it's up to 10. But the issue that is being joined by the mayors of Dallas and Houston, who have written all the other mayors in the state and asked them to join in a coalition to do whatever they can do, up to and including legal action against the utility to stop the construction of these plants. Now, are you ready for this, Gavin and Rocky, for these battles yourself? Have you already done something like this? You had to in your
well,
careers?
We just got a BlackBerry a moment ago in California. We just sued all the big auto manufacturers for the impact they've had on global warming. If you can sue tobacco companies, you can sue the gun manufacturers. Why not sue the automobile industry? And that's exactly what the Attorney General in California did this morning. So we have no problem with litigation in terms of moral adjustments and trying to encourage to do the right thing.
Yeah, what a shame that it comes down to that, though. I think that the building of more dangerous, dirty coal-burning power plants, I think, is the greatest reflection of a lack of imagination, a lack of leadership on both the state and federal level. The fact that we've got mayors from Houston and Dallas doing this now, a year, 5 years ago, it would have been unthinkable. I think that that sends a real signal to the power companies, to the regulators, to legislators. They need to start moving in another direction, because if they keep committing to coal, it's a very bad thing for them economically down the road, because the tide is turning dramatically. We're going to see, I think, renewable portfolio standards in every state, hopefully nationally. And the governor of the state of Utah just recently appointed a blue ribbon task force on climate change. I think that is a very good signal, even in a state like Utah, the reddest state in the country, by the way, and I'm proud to be the mayor of its capital city. There are a lot of those outside of our city boundaries who wish that weren't so. But when you file this litigation, there can be huge costs. I sued to stop a major highway coming into our community, to stop sprawl development, to stop more pollution coming in from funneling tens of thousands more cars each day. We prevailed in that lawsuit, but I can tell you our state legislature has put me at the center of their target every single session since then. But we need leadership. We need people who will stand up, because it will bring about these kinds of changes. And I'm proud to hear that both from California and Texas.
Could we have a round of applause for the panel? Thank you.